This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. This past November, mass protests erupted in Iran over raised oil prices. How did the government respond? It shut off the internet. For days, people in Iran could not communicate online with anybody inside or outside the country. More and more, governments are turning to internet blackouts as a way to control their citizens. Indian-controlled Kashmir experienced 59 complete or partial internet blackouts last year, all in response to protests. Late last year, we asked you to pitch us the shows that you wanted to hear on 1A. And all this month, we'll be bringing you shows based on your top five listener picks. This one was pitched by 1A listener Eric Roth, and here's what Eric had to say.
How do regimes like Iran and Turkey actually shut down the internet? How does this decision change the lives of their citizens? And what happens inside the countries? How else do governments control information on the internet? And is there some way that citizens can avoid censorship? Is there a technical way around this nonsense?
Thanks for sending us those questions, Eric. They were so good that we decided to make a show. And here it is. To help us understand these questions and to answer them, Justin Sherman is here. He's a cybersecurity policy fellow at New America and a fellow at the Duke Center on Law and Technology at Duke University School of Law. Justin, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also here is Nima Fatami. He's the founding director of Can Do. They're a cybersecurity nonprofit. He's also an independent security researcher. Nima, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me here.
Justin, what exactly is an internet blackout? What does it look like inside a country or a region when it happens?
An internet blackout is something that probably sounds very foreign to people in democracies, but it is what it sounds. It's actually blacking out the communication systems that run the backbone of the internet. So citizens can't use messaging services like WhatsApp. They can't access Facebook or Twitter. And sometimes in tandem with these internet shutdowns, we also see shutdowns of cellular communication services.
This means no information on the internet. You said no WhatsApp and other internet-based communication services. And this must also mean no information leaving the country by any of these methods, not just getting in.
That's correct. And that's also part of the motivation in many of these internet shutdown cases we see, is that not only do governments want to perhaps, as you said, suppress protest or suppress assembly, but also prevent outsiders and the international community from seeing what's going on the ground within those countries.
Well, tell me a little bit more about why a government completely would shut off the internet in a time of crisis or protest, at least crisis that it perceives. Ostensibly, it also inhibits the government's ability to communicate its message.
Absolutely. Internet shutdowns can have a variety of motivations. Oftentimes, it is a straight matter of just suppressing protests and trying to prevent people from assembling en masse. During the Arab Spring, we saw many countries do this as people were blogging and using Twitter to take to the streets. But there are also other motivations for internet shutdowns, particularly in light of misinformation. We've seen this in India, where misinformation frequently goes rampant on WhatsApp. And there have been a number of horrific cases over the past several years where citizens have gotten information that someone in their area has perhaps committed a certain crime or violated some particular ethnic or cultural norm, and then that person is killed, dragged down into the street by a mob and killed. And so they've had several instances of this. But internet shutdowns, from the Indian government's perspective, have been a way to purportedly stop the spread of this misinformation once it hits a service like WhatsApp. So there are a range of motivations, but that doesn't mean that these shutdowns aren't repressive.
Nima Fatemi, you were in Iran in 2009 for the presidential election and the aftermath, which was the protest known as the Green Revolution, when the government tried to shut down mass communication at that moment. What was the internet like then? Was it a blackout? Was it something different? Can you talk a little bit about what it was like to be in Iran at that time?
First of all, let me correct you that it was, green movement, not revolution. It was basically people were simply demanding within the framework of the constitution of the country that they wanted to vote for the votes to be recounted and wanted to make sure that the integrity of the election was protected. But back then, we were not using internet as widely as we are today. So the first reaction that they had was basically blocking all of the cell phone communication. So you couldn't call anybody on cell phone. You couldn't text anybody. Like, text messages were completely blocked. And that basically stopped people from being able to mobilize and organize in response to what was going on around the election.
What was the effect on the street?
Well, for the first, I think, day or the first 24 hours or so, it was just like a shock, a big shock across the country where everybody was just like, at least around me, everybody was just in deep shock and didn't know what was going on. Nobody could believe what was happening. But then immediately after that, as people were starting to like wake up and realize that what's going on, people basically start to like take down, you know, go down to the streets and start to basically mobilize and organize in different ways.
Now, during the most recent protests in Iran this past November, the government did successfully shut down the internet for several days. And as I understand it, this was the first time that you and your team were not able to find ways around the blackouts, not able to find ways under or around or over the walls. What was different this time? This sounds like an arms race.
It is, but I need to clarify something. The work, like, one of the most important points of these kind of blackouts or this kind of retaliations by different regimes is that we need to think about this entire phenomena as a class warfare. So one thing that they did was that they differentiated the price. Like, they basically broke net neutrality in Iran. Like, so they said, if your traffic is inside the country, you pay half the price for your traffic. And people basically pay for their traffic based on the volume of the traffic in Iran. So
that's an incentive to be more under control.
Yes,
right?
But in reality, it's actually that you pay twice amount if you want to like let your traffic to go outside of the country.
And who has the money?
Exactly. It becomes a class issue.
So I'm going to ask you about technical avenues to shutting down the internet, but what you just said is fascinating. The pricing structure is built toward censorship in Iran. It helps, the way you pay for internet helps the government shut it down when it wants to.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that not a lot of people have the research on is the economy around censorship.
We're going to talk a lot more about that. I'm speaking with Nima Fatemi, founder of CanDo, a cybersecurity nonprofit. Also, Justin Sherman is with a cybersecurity policy fellow at New America. Coming up, there are a lot of ways that governments can control the internet, from banning certain websites to shutting it off completely. We're going to explore the options if you're an authoritarian and talk about how some American tech companies are complicit in the censorship. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now, Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
NPR's Life Kit wants to help you make changes that actually stick this new year. From how to do dry January to how to start a creative habit, we've got new episodes all month to help you start the year off right. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're talking about how governments control the internet. Justin Sherman, what are some of the ways that governments can control the internet, aside from just blacking it out?
There are a variety of ways governments can control the internet. And I actually think if we're thinking about these techniques and these policies as a sort of toolbox, internet blackouts are more like a hammer. They're pretty blunt. They don't require, in some cases, a lot of technical sophistication in order to do them. But there are tools that are more like a scalpel. A great example would be the Great Firewall in China, which uses the blacklisting of IP addresses, machine learning to look for particular kinds of content posts, and a variety of techniques that essentially aim to block things based on where they're headed, where they're coming from, and the content. So there's really a range of ways that governments can control the web in this vein.
So if you're an authoritarian or aspiring authoritarian, when would you get out the hammer? When is a blackout appropriate? Or is it just the tool of the technically non-sophisticated?
Every now and then we see a very technically sophisticated country black out the internet. But in many cases, countries that engage in internet shutdowns do so because they lack the scale and sophistication for filtering content. I mentioned India earlier, and that's a great example because with the misinformation that had been viral on WhatsApp, the Indian government had actually gone to WhatsApp several times and requested that they give them some sort of way to monitor posts in real time so they could stop the spread of misinformation. And WhatsApp, rightfully in my view, said no. And so the Indian government's response in many of these cases is to turn to that hammer-esque technique of just blacking out communications entirely because they don't have more sophisticated mechanisms to catch this misinformation.
You mentioned the Great Firewall in China, the selective and sophisticated blocking of IP addresses, machine learning. Take me inside a little bit more about what technically savvy, sophisticated censorship looks like today.
I think it's important to put this in historical context. For a couple of decades, liberal democracies have largely thought about the internet as this inherently open and free and democratic space. And so the way to accrue its benefits, the logic has gone, is to remain relatively hands-off as a government. Authoritarian regimes, on the other hand, at least those in China, Russia, Iran, initially saw the internet very differently. They saw the free flow of information as a security risk, as a threat to regime stability. And so very early on, there were a coalition of countries that started to build out these censorship and surveillance mechanisms in order to clamp down on the web. From the very start, exactly. And so there's a variety of techniques that they've been building, but because they've been doing it for so many years, because they've been investing so much money in it, because China has a large technical talent base on which to draw to do these things, they've become in many ways the sort of global leader in censorship and control.
Here's a little bit of internet censorship that sounds, in comparison to what we're talking about, relatively benign. A listener tweeted, in Ethiopia recently, internet connections were blocked for many days, ostensibly to prevent students cheating during exams, but it created chaos throughout the country. Justin, what do you know about Ethiopia? Does that sound plausible to you?
It sounds plausible that occurred, but I think what this person mentioned is right on point in that there are always collateral effects of these internet shutdowns because while the government perhaps was well-intentioned in some ways in preventing students from cheating, or we can imagine other cases where the government might have a very particular legitimate motivation, there are still many other people who depend on those communication systems who are going to be hurt by having them taken offline.
Now, I want to talk about the United States because when you talk about internet blackouts, immediately many Americans' minds go to rumors they've heard or that they've read about online about the kill switch, the internet kill switch. Now, in 2012, President Obama did sign an executive order that gave the U.S. government a so-called kill switch for the internet or the power to shut off the internet. Justin, is this a real thing? Does the government have the authority to do it or do they actually have the ability to do it?
I think there was a lot of unnecessary panic about what happened with President Obama, and I think in large part that's due to branding it as a kill switch. The internet in the United States is relatively decentralized compared to other countries. In China, for example, there are only a few major gateways that connect the global web to the web within China. So it's much easier for the government to go in, and whether that's force those companies to do something or tap those ISPs on the shoulder and make them do something, it's much easier to control the web when it's more centralized. That's not the case in the United States. It's a lot more decentralized. And of course, we live in a democracy. So that also makes it fundamentally different from many of these other countries where there isn't rule of law and where there aren't checks and balances that would prevent the government from going in and turning off the web.
So just to be clear, if the U.S. government has the in extremis authority to shut down the internet, you're saying in a practical world, even though they have the authority, the ability to do it is not that easy. It may not be easy, but can it be done?
It would be quite difficult compared to any internet shutdowns we've seen so far in other countries.
Nima, what's your perspective on an internet kill switch? Some people had a vision of a toggle switch on the resolution a Resolute desk, you know, in the Oval Office. The president just kills the switch.
I think what we have to consider is the path that we are on. Like, for example, right now, Facebook and Amazon and Google, basically, these three companies control the vast majority of everything that you do online. And we are seeing, like, ridiculous censorship on Instagram, and nobody can do anything about it because there's little to no regulations on all of these, like, mega tech companies on how they are handling this information.
There is government censorship. There is also corporate censorship. And we're going to talk about corporate censorship, especially as big American tech companies do more and more business overseas and want access to countries like India and China. Nima, your group, though, looks for those workarounds when governments censor the internet, when they put up the walls. You try to get around them and over them and under them. In the past, when you were able to get around online censorship, we're not super technically savvy right now, but give me a sense of what that looks like, how you go to work to get past the censors.
So basically what we do is that we generally look at what is allowed as traffic in any network. And then by studying what is allowed, we try to look and see if we can reshape the traffic to look like the traffic that is actually allowed. Imagine like just, you know, like you go to USPS and there are boxes there. There are certain boxes that are allowed and there's certain boxes that are not allowed. You basically reshape your traffic to look like the boxes that are allowed. And then inside that box, you put your encrypted traffic so it looks like normal traffic for the inspectors.
Sounds completely logical. And as you describe it, it makes me think of Star Wars when Luke and Leia and Han dressed up like stormtroopers and they got into the Death Star and did their business, a similar principle. Okay, I understand that. You make the traffic look like traffic that's allowed, and then you get in. But if it's just you and your buddies, it can do. Who cares? I mean, how do you then give the people who want to access, let's say Iran, want to get information in, want to get counter information in, how do you enable them to piggyback on your ability to hide your traffic?
Once we basically find a way in and out, that's when we can actually start to like look into like what is possible and what is not. But in situation like Iran, we just couldn't do anything because it was like completely blocked. And this time around, it was completely blocked. I mean, there were certain ways that we could get around, but again, it was not scalable. So because it was not scalable, we couldn't use them because only enabled people could actually access the internet.
And I assume for every disguise you and your colleagues or the community comes up with, the Iranians are smart too. They're coming up with countermeasures and new ways to keep you out. We got a voicemail from a listener who had a personal experience with online censorship while visiting China. Here's what we got in our inbox.
Hello, Patricia from Cleveland, Ohio. Just wanted to comment that I took a recent trip to Shanghai, China. And during that time, we had no access, even while you're in the hotel with Wi-Fi, to Facebook, YouTube, and our email. When we questioned the guides about that, they said you had to buy your own VPN. And my one person that I was traveling with had purchased that and still had no success. And it did make it minimally difficult for travel. One, you couldn't connect with family and friends back in the United States easily. And so often we're trying to Google where we're at just to learn a little bit more history about the place.
Nima, Patricia couldn't do the simple things like Googling where she's at or communicating with relatives in the United States. She also can't publish incendiary or anti-government things on the internet, of course, or pro-democracy things if she's a democratically minded American. Are there ways for everyday people who aren't cybersecurity experts to circumvent this kind of online censorship? You get to the hotel, they say you got to buy a special VPN, you can't get on Google. Is there anything a regular person can do?
Sadly, in different countries, the censorship techniques that they use is different. What something that I would recommend to everybody is to download Tor browser. Tor browser is one of the
Tor browser.
They can go to torproject.org and download the Tor browser. The significance of Tor browser is that it has multiple technologies combined in one package. So if one technique doesn't work to bypass censorship, it will rely on the second one. But unfortunately, when it comes to China or Iran, sometimes even Tor browser doesn't work because the ways of which they do censorship changes very rapidly. And it's just an arm race that we have to like keep up. And sadly, people have to do a lot of research before traveling to these places.
That's upper hand for a government. So we're going to talk about more governments around the world. We're going to talk about what actually happened when the lights go out on the internet. If you're a protester, if you're a regular citizen, more ways that governments can control the internet and more ways that people like Nima find their way around it to help protect democracy. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp, a truly affordable online counseling service. Fill out a questionnaire online and get matched with a licensed counselor best suited to your mental health needs. Whether it's depression, anxiety, or trauma, BetterHelp will help you overcome what stands in the way of your happiness. Learn more at BetterHelp.com and get 10% off your first month with promo code 1A. BetterHelp. Get help anytime, anywhere.
Planet Money is the mountaineer economist behind the carbon tax. It's the baseball player trying to get a pay raise, the prisoner building a blockchain out of cans of mackerel. Planet Money from NPR. Listen now.
Back now to our conversation about censorship on the World Wide Web with cybersecurity policy fellow Justin Sherman of The New America and cybersecurity researcher Nima Fatami. Justin, are more governments getting into the game of controlling and or blacking out the internet? We talked about China, India, some of these sophisticates. Who are the newcomers when it comes to authoritarian censorship?
We've actually seen more democracies as well as authoritarian countries start to control the web more in various ways over the past several years. After the horrific terror attack in Christchurch, New Zealand, for example, the Australian government passed a law requiring very quick takedowns of terrorist content on social media. In South Korea, to use another democratic example, the government has begun filtering out citizens' access to gambling websites. So we've seen democracies start to exert more control in various ways, and then we've seen countries like Vietnam, which are already quite authoritarian offline, start to copy a country like China and institute very tight censorship and surveillance mechanisms on the web.
Well, I want to compare 10 years ago in this game to today. At the top of the show, Justin, you briefly mentioned Egypt. I want to talk a little bit about Egypt because that was one of the first places, one of the first flare-ups in the Arab Spring, where we saw bloggers getting online, fomenting a protest against the Mubarak government, especially on Facebook. Some of those people are still well-known. The Egyptian government trying and in some cases failing, in some cases succeeding to prevent that internet traffic. Take me back to Egypt a little bit and compare it to what authoritarian-led internet shutdowns look like today and what everybody has learned in the meantime.
There are many similarities. One similarity, as you said, is that the government saw this mobilization occurring, didn't like it, and decided that what they were going to do was, among other things, you know, in addition to, for example, brutal police and military crackdowns, was to go to those internet companies within the country and make them turn off their services in the hopes that that would stop people from mobilizing, but that isn't necessarily the case that people are going to stop protesting just because you unplug the internet. But that's also a similarity we still see today, as many countries, for example, with the protests at the end of 2019 in Iraq, turning off the web to try and stop people from mobilizing. And while that may have some effects in some ways, people largely still continue to protest. And in some cases, you could argue that that probably increases people's outrage at the government for turning off their communication services.
Nima, 10 years ago versus today, you got into this game just about 10 years ago. Again, maybe not on too much of a technical basis, but help me understand how the game has changed in your confrontation with governments who try to shut down the internet.
Yeah, I think there are multiple important points that we need to think about here. One is that we can't talk about internet shutdowns and internet censorship without talking about surveillance. Surveillance is the key about censorship. It is when governments basically try all the means that they have at their disposal to have mass surveillance on their own people, just like the U.S. has on its own people. And if that fails, basically they resort to censorship and then internet shutdowns. There has been multiple protests across the world where you would attend the protest and you will like realize that, oh, my phone is not working, the signal is bad. But like, why is there no signal? Like some people say, oh, like there are a lot of people there. That could be the reason. But a lot of the cases, it is because of some signal jammings, because of like, so you can't broadcast what's happening from that moment to the rest of the world, so it wouldn't add to the mass of the people who are protesting. And the other fact that is really important, I think, that we have to consider is the effect of U.S. laws on internet censorship across the world. During the past couple of years, we see that U.S., through its maximum pressure policy, has began to basically kick Iranian users off its platforms, such as Slack, such as GitHub, GitLab, Amazon AWS, which basically runs about two-thirds of the, if I'm not mistaken, about two-thirds of the internet infrastructure, and basically forcing all of the Iranian tech community to move their servers inside the country, which exactly is what Iranian wants. And then it just basically minimized the cost for the Iranian government to just shut down the internet.
It's very interesting. You're talking about the unintended consequences of maximum pressure, a policy that may have a lot of merits to people at the State Department. Of course, there are always unintended consequences in a complex world, especially in a technologically complex world. We've alluded several times already in the program to government censorship versus corporate censorship, and I want to talk about it in detail now. I want to play you a man named John Hennessy. He's chairman of Alphabet Incorporated, and if you have not heard of Alphabet, they're a parent company to a company you have heard of called Google. Well, Mr. Hennessy spoke to Bloomberg in 2018, and he explained what he sees as the challenges of doing business in China when it comes to adhering to China's censorship demands.
Anybody who does business in China compromises some of their core values, every single company, because the laws in China are quite a bit different than they are in our own country. The question that I think comes to my mind and that I struggle with is, are we better off giving Chinese citizens a decent search engine, a capable search engine, even if it is restricted and censored in some cases, than a search engine that's not very good?
That was Alphabet Inc. Chair John Hennessy, the parent company of Google. Now, Justin, what do you hear there? Do you hear the rationalizations of a man who knows how big that market is and how many hundreds of billions are at stake? I mean, what about the big private tech companies? In many ways, China can't censor its internet, at least to the outside world, without their help. And we've seen example after example of Google agreeing to the Chinese government censorship demands in order to get access to that emerging, massive, very rich market.
That's exactly one of the concerns. We've heard a lot about China exporting censorship over the past few years, and there are sort of two main ways we can think about that. The former is the government actually training foreign countries on surveillance, setting up internet control systems. But this falls into the latter category, which is China using its economic influence, as this executive just discussed, to force companies that either are incorporated in its borders or those incorporated outside to censor things at its behest. So yeah, we've, you know, many companies that have tried to break into the Chinese market have run into this issue where they are going to have to censor things for the government, and they are probably going to have little to no say as to whether or not they get to push back.
Now, Justin, you've said a couple of times the two internets, the free and open democratic internet that was the vision when it was first started versus the come along lately, which is the internet is a threat and how authoritarian governments have responded to that. But it's worth remembering in the corporate context, this was not the internet that we were promised. This was not what the internet was supposed to be. We were promised unfettered, free and open democratizing communication, not massive corporations that use their leverage on the internet to assist in anti-democratic forces getting more anti-democratic.
Absolutely. And in hindsight, there's sort of this delusional techno-utopianism that a lot of people had in thinking that you could build a telecommunication system, which is essentially what the internet is, and have that be divorced from every possible political or economic or historical structure in the world. And so that's been, like you said, the realization of the past few years is, yes, the internet may have various unique properties. Like Nima said, it is a very powerful tool for connecting people, for helping them mobilize, but that doesn't mean governments can't control it. And that doesn't mean that corporations won't have an outsized influence on issues like censorship, issues like communication.
And all of those incentives. If you want to access our emerging market, you want to access those billions, you want to make your shareholders happy, you need to play ball. And ball can be a very ugly game.
In China, the market is, in the words of these technology executives, simply too large to ignore. And so the thought that China would suddenly move aside and think that companies aren't going to want to try and keep competing in that market, even if there's censorship, is just not the case. So for the next several years, we're going to see this issue play out where companies are going to try and break in the market. And in some cases, I'm sure they will not engage, or they will engage in very narrow ways. And in other cases, we'll see, or maybe we'll have leaked in media reports, how companies engage in ways that are perhaps quite problematic.
And what about Facebook? How it's maybe a whole hour we could talk about Facebook in this dynamic. But in the shorter sense, has Facebook changed the nature of censorship, especially when they interact with governments like this?
Facebook, I think, has taken issues of censorship and put them into a corporate setting in ways we haven't seen before. Because, you know, if we think about corporate censorship, really prior to many of these internet companies, we probably think about issues like employees protesting at work or things you say in the workplace. But really now, as we've seen, whether it's fake news, whether it's terrorist content, whether it's hate speech on their platform, we've seen Facebook forced in many ways to address these issues that I think they either were just ignoring or didn't want to look at in the first place.
Nima, if you're good at what you do, and I'm sure that you are, and you know how to get past firewalls and you know how to get in when the bad guys want to keep you out, I would imagine the United States government is very interested in your work. I would imagine they want you to work for them, or they want your expertise. What's your interaction been like with the U.S. government? Have they called on you to help them with Iran or another country?
There are parts of the U.S. government, namely the State Department, that is actually eager in making sure that access to information remains in censored countries such as Iran. We are always open to whoever is willing to talk about these issues, and we do talk to them. That being said, we are trying at CANDU to not to, you know, like engage with any government, so we can be able to openly criticize them whenever there is a need to and call them out. But I just wanted to reflect on the corporate surveillance and corporate censorship side of things as a challenge that Iranians face regularly, is that there are sometimes that some technologies are not censored inside the country, but when Iranians try to actually connect to them, they are blocked from this site because of sanctions or because the U.S. companies are censoring them.
Again, unintended consequences, which we talked about before. Censorship is on the march, both from governments and even from some of our American corporate citizens. Justin Sherman, cybersecurity policy fellow at New America, fellow at the Duke Center on Law and Technology at Duke University. Justin, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Nima Fatsami, founding director of Can Do, an independent security researcher. Nima, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
This conversation was produced by Haley Blassengame and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.